Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Ruth Miller from Embroidered Realism. Ruth, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. I'm glad to be here, and Beth as well. Thank you.
Yeah, glad to have you. All right, the first thing out of the gate is when I was doing research on you, I never imagined that your embroidered portraiture is what is your main thing, and you have so much other things to offer, but I never imagined that you were doing life-sized embroidered portraiture until I saw that one picture with a guy with some leaves around, and I saw clearly that his head was life-size. What got you doing things life-size? That is just, what an undertaking.
Well, I guess it started back when I was in school. When I was in college, you had to make big work in order to be, quote, professional. So that led me to want to make big pieces to be taken seriously. But there's also a practical reason. I'm using woolen yarns in order to create my images. And I want to get really smooth combinations of yarn, of colors, I should say, not yarns, but the colors. I want the color gradations to be not choppy and rough looking. So yeah, to accommodate the size of the yarn, I use a larger image. And every piece is not huge in itself, but they're still life-size. If I want to make a smaller piece, I just crop the image.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they're not all 5 feet. You know, that's a huge undertaking.
Make a 5 foot
embroidery.
Yeah. But, okay. So that brings up the other question then. In today's world of 500 million thread types, why stick with wool yarn? Is it just because it gives you a texture you're after, or what is it that it does for you?
Some of it's automatic programming. The work that inspired me at the beginning of my career, when I was still a teenager, I didn't even have a career, but I had seen some woven, not portraits, but figurative art, and it was done in wool. I had, prior to that, been using embroidery floss. So when I made the switch, you know, and I thought, well, with the switch, you know, I could make bigger pieces faster. But, it accommodates the size of the yarn mostly.
Okay.
So it's dramatic. It's practical. There are lots of reasons. This particular yarn, though, is very beautiful. It comes in 300 plus colors from the Pattern Iron Company. It's different than any other wool that I've ever used or seen, for that matter, in that it looks, there's a slight sheen to it that makes it look like well-conditioned human hair.
Oh.
So there are little micro effects that you really can't see unless you're in the presence of the work, mm-hmm. but that add to it.
That's interesting in itself, because we don't generally think of wool as really offering much more than just fuzz, but because that's what, three ply, so you use one ply most of the time?
Yes, I started off using all three because I said, well, this will help make the work go faster, but I found that when I wanted to do the flesh portions, I wanted the effect to be much smoother. So that led me to separate the plies.
Oh, okay.
But then I got used to that look, and though it takes a little longer, I like the flatness of it.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about this particular yarn is that even the one ply has a twist. Each ply is twisted. Two strand twists.
Okay.
So that makes it a very strong yarn. So, you know, the fabric backing that I use is relatively coarse. So you can imagine that with the needle going in and out, it would wear those fuzzy wool bits off. But right. It doesn't with this yarn.
Oh, because that was the other thing that when I saw you using wool, I thought, boy, a few passes through the ground cloth and you're going to have fuzz everywhere, but it doesn't do that, huh?
No, and apparently this wool was made to be suitable for Persian rugs, so that they would take quite a bit of abrasion, say.
Yeah.
You know, in the course of the lifetime of a rug.
Right.
So I'm really happy with this.
Now, at Life Size Pieces, you must own a truckload of pattern A and wool.
Yes, I do. I do. I got lucky early on in my career. I got a grant that was really project-based, but, you know, I cheated and bought enough wool for all the projects to come in the future. I wanted to make the most of it.
Yep. Hey, can't
That's
blame
good
you
planning.
There.
Yep. Good planning. Yep. Good planning.
Now, from what I read, you grew up in a creative and supportive home to lead you to do this kind of work. Seemed like your mother was there and taught you, and you really had an opportunity as a child to develop your skills.
Oh, yes, yes. My mother was an angel, as is everyone's mother, but she was a teacher as well. She was a public school teacher, so education itself was important to her. Cultural education was important to her. So my whole background is well-rounded, and you might say, well, what effect does that have on the art you do now? Say, you know, I had one class in sight singing. What does that have to do with anything? Well, I had never heard of sight singing. But every single thing that we learn that's in our experience can be used later. We don't know at the time, but it will come in handy for the narrative aspects of the work that you have. When you get ready to tell your story, you sort of draw on all these past experiences. So I never would have known. We had dancing lessons, you know, we went to plays and theater and opera, and we learned to play musical instruments. I took the violin and the piano, which I can't even read music now, sorry to say, but... It all impacts the art.
Yeah. So you got a well-rounded upbringing. So you had exposure to all types of things, which really allowed you to choose what interested you.
Yes, I did. And my mother was furthermore beyond that. She wasn't pushy in any one direction. She saw that I drew all the time, and she nurtured that. Of course, my sister and brother, you know, had the same opportunities, but she watched to see what each child was drawn to.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. I recommend that to any mothers out there.
Yeah, yeah. And so
fathers.
Well, yeah, yeah, exactly. The drawing then, that started early, and you've never quit drawing.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I still have one drawing from the third grade where I had made a Mother's Day card for my mother. So I still have the page where I printed slowly, you know, the words for the card, and another piece on newsprint, no less. I don't know how it lasted, but yeah, early on.
Yeah. And that's still, drawing is still really the basis, the start for your art today, then. You still use drawing as your starting point.
Yes, I never considered myself a painter. I don't feel I have an aptitude for paint. My work looks sort of painterly, but it's more like the kind of image one would make with colored pencil. And mm-hmm. that it's a series of small strokes. There are no broad washes of color, although with yarn you can duplicate a broad wash of color. But no, I'm a draftsman, really, and drawing is my first love.
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting.
Some of your work,
oh, go ahead, Beth.
Some of your work, especially some of the faces, I see like a Van Gogh influence on the way you use how he had his paint strokes, and I see that in your work. So I just see that influence.
Thank you. Van Gogh was an influence. I wouldn't have said in the type of strokes he used, more in the coloring and the textural aspects of it. But Beth, it might be that Van Gogh's maybe the stitching has a comparable effect to the type of brush strokes that he used, just stitching by itself, not because it's mine, but the nature of stitching being discrete particles of color for each stitch. That might be sort of Van Gogh-like. I hadn't thought of that.
Yes. Very much so. Very much so.
It was interesting, the quote you made about school. I never attended schools to acquire degrees or certifications because I never imagined any financial award. Knowledge was its own reward, the prime mover, the source of delight. Now, most of us go to school to make money at some point. But
yes, and I have a feeling that's the reason we're finding ourselves as a country in the situation we're in, because money cannot be the basis for how we live our lives. It's just not wise.
Yeah.
It's too simple. That's what it is. It's too simple. It doesn't take into account all the facets of life. But, you know, it wasn't my better character, really, that drove that decision. I just happened to be interested in how life works.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think I bring that to my art, but that was the main driver behind that. If your education is so single-pointed and focused on just money, then you lose the big picture and you don't even know if you're in the right industry and in the right company. You don't know if you're headed in the right direction if your education is too narrow.
Okay, I'm out.
It doesn't feed the soul. It doesn't feed the soul, does it? If you're just going after a degree to get that degree and to get money at the end,
well, not
you're missing
only,
something.
Yeah. But not only doesn't it feed the soul, every job we took in, and I've had a lot of jobs from painting faces on mannequins to regular retail, postal service, everything. You don't know how your action fits into the human scheme of things unless you know what else is out there. And if you focus too early in life, you don't know if you're going to end up headed in just the wrong direction. Not only will it not be satisfying, you might decide, well, this isn't even, well, it's harmful. say you mm-hmm. said, well, I want to make a lot of money, and you end up in oil drilling. You know, very few people decide to embroider for money, but, you know, you might find that your career has sent you in a direction you didn't want to go.
Oh, I'm going to have to think about this a little bit. Yeah, I agree with you, but wow, I have to look back at my life path here now. Oops.
Oh, God.
You're still young. You're still young,
well,
Gary.
Not only that, it brought you to embroidery and fiber art nevertheless.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, yeah.
So, you know, there's not one path.
Yeah. Talk to me about the Fashion Institute of Technology, where you learned, was it leather making, shoe making, and bag making? That you talk about.
Yes.
You talk about a whole other world of things, of art.
Oh, yes, I loved it. I loved it. Fashion Institute is a college that is set up to service all phases of the fashion industry. Now, at the time that I went there, I was an adult, I had children, I worked as a typist, but you know, once I heard about the courses being open to everyone, I took leather making first, I think. And that opened the way. Well, it was required. I really wanted to learn to make shoes, and I did take a shoemaking course, but leather working was required first to get you comfortable with the materials. And then from there, I still liked leather, and so I went into bag making. But to learn to be in the company of people who take their work seriously, who value quality over quantity, who want to know everything from the financial aspect to, you know, the creation of the product itself. All that, you know, no one there. I've gone to a lot of schools, and I can say with surety that no one there goes to waste their time or to indulge a parent or anything that. They all have a commitment or a love for fashion.
Yeah. Did you ever make a pair of shoes that you actually wore?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes, I made yeah, at the end of the class, I was able to wear, you know, they gave you a last to make your shoes on. I got the last to fit my foot. So, you know, I was able to wear the shoes. They were a pair of mules. They weren't difficult, you know, but I've worn them. The soles are scuffed, you know, but they held up too. It's been a long time.
That's great. I
So
can see
it was
that as a
helpful.
professor. Your requirement is, yeah, you got to make shoes, but you got to be able to walk 2 miles in them without doubling over in pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's fun. So what is it that gets you to embroidery? So we have all of these life experiences. Drawing is your first love. You have exposure to all kinds of art. What is it that gets you to embroidery as a way of expressing your art when, you know, painting, photography, whatever it might be, would work just as well? Why is it needle and thread?
Well, I didn't consider photography. I've never been a good photographer, but every school that I've gone to, even elementary school, emphasized painting. And with painting is messy. Before I had children, I was prissy enough to say, "Oh, it's gooey, it's nasty. I don't like this." You know. So, you know, after
You're
you
one of
have
those kids. You're one of
changed
those
diapers
kids.
for 1 year, yes. But once you change diapers, you know, then paint's not so bad. But at the time I made the switch, I didn't have any children. So, you know, I thought I already learned to embroider as you know, I don't know, maybe an 8 7 8 year old. So I was already familiar and somewhat facile with that medium. You know, I used it just to put the little daisies on the tablecloth or whatever, or the apron, you know, things that probably people don't even use now. But, you know, I loved it. I loved the slowness of it. I loved the fact that I got to work with my aunt who embroidered, you know, as an adult, certainly. you know, after work, you know, for her own enjoyment. But I don't think it's that far of a stretch. Once you throw out the messiness of paint, you know, you have to have some other medium.
Yeah.
You know, and I like it because it can make a line that's suitable to drawing, certainly.
Yeah.
Because even with a tablecloth, you're drawing.
Right. I get a sense that there was a special connection with your aunt.
Oh, yes. My aunt Mildred. Oh, she was also the first person who I knew who made money at home from crafts.
Oh.
Now she worked as a waitress, really, at Chock Full of Nuts. But later when she had other jobs, she would make the crafts at home. She'd crochet and embroider and things like that, mostly crocheting. But she took those things to her jobs and sold them to her coworkers. And I didn't know people could do that. So that was like an early introduction to working at home for money.
Yeah.
So even though she didn't ask much money and didn't make much money, but the very idea, you know, I thought everybody had a job,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But I didn't know you could make a job.
So she showed you the path then that wasn't going and getting a regular 9-to-5 drive job then.
Yes. It was a long time though before I followed that path. You know, I had lots of jobs, but you know, that goes back to my earlier point that whatever you learn is not wasted. When it came time for me to say, okay, I'm going to take the leap. Now, when I took the leap of faith, I waited till my youngest had graduated from high school so that theoretically, at least, you know, all my children could be self-supporting. They could mm-hmm. sign a contract and get an apartment. And, you know, if I slid into poverty and homelessness following my art, that they would be protected. They were able to protect right. themselves.
Right.
So
right.
So you know, you know. But still, everything, nothing's wasted. Everything can be used.
Yeah. Yep. So was your art always portraiture, or did you start with some other form of needlework and then work your way to portraiture?
Well, I started with decorative patterns, you know, as I mentioned in the tablecloths and what have you. But for myself, the work was always figurative, you know, unless someone gave an assignment to do a landscape or still life or what have you. But my work by choice was always figurative, but I always worked from imagination. It's only when I got to Cooper Union and was really forced to work from life that I decided I liked it. And also I could do it fairly quickly. I teach drawing now sometimes. And what there are lots of people who look at my work and say, oh, I could never do that. But I start the way my teacher did in showing you how one creates a likeness with a non-figurative, not non-figurative, but non-human object. Mm-hmm. A human face is very complicated. So I start my classes with a toothpaste box.
Oh.
And if you can get it to look like that, I'll get something more complicated and more complicated, and we'll work on it till we get to the face. And then I show people who are doubters that they can do this.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing that I wondered about, because you know, the human body in general is difficult to create through art, and you just have a real style to it. Did that come fairly naturally, or did you have to work pretty hard to get to the point where you could create the realistic looks that you get?
Well, even when I worked from imagination, I was pretty good. I'll put it
Okay,
that way.
okay.
I was good enough to get into Cooper Union. Cooper Union is a school that was essentially free at the time. All you had to buy was supplies and pay for administrative costs. But the tuition was entirely free, but you had to pass the entrance test. So I was good enough to pass the entrance test to get in it. I had already been to an arts high school, but I don't say, sorry to say, I didn't learn quite so much there. But at Cooper Union, my drawing teacher was excellent, as all the teachers were excellent, but I really took to the way he taught the classes.
Yeah. So
So will
that's
you rephrase your question again as far as being specific about getting a likeness?
Well, it just seems that, you know,
Or was that in your question?
For so many people, it's just difficult to create the human body, no matter what portion of it it is. And your art is just so beautifully done, and you know the lines and the way you handled, you know, the facial features. And so I just wondered if that came naturally or was just a lot of work. And then of course, you know, there's doing that with a pencil and a piece of paper, but then to do that with needle and thread to me is like two more levels higher of difficulty.
Well, yes, it is. I'm not fast at all, even after all these years. And while I'm stitching, say it takes a year to make a piece, while I'm stitching, I'm not drawing. So in that year, I'm going to get rusty. And believe it or not, every time I start a piece, I think, oh my goodness, how am I going to do this? You need to practice, and you need to keep in practice. But as I work, I continually make adjustments. I'm just the way with I start off with pencil and paper. I have an eraser. That's the first set of adjustments. But when I'm stitching, I'm still making adjustments. And sometimes, in fact, with every single piece, I have to take my tweezers and fingernail scissors and pull out the mistakes. So there's never a time where, okay, it's just, one stitch after another. It's not all planned in my head. It comes out as I'm doing it.
So, do your pieces kind of speak to you as you stitch on them? Do they say, "Oh, I need this"?
Yes. But that's always something I consider unfortunate because it means then I have to change something. But yes, mostly I hope that, okay, if things were ideal, the look of the piece and the narrative would be entirely planned out before I even started with the first stitch. Because anytime I, get inspired in the middle of it, something has to go. Something has to be undone. So I try. But that's also a pleasant aspect of stitching. Anyone who stitches is comfortable in that zone where you stitch after stitching, all your stress winds down and you're focused on, the fabric in front of you. That's it's a mitigated, unfortunate situation, I'll say. But no, it if you for view for listeners to your podcast who go to my website later, you will see where I have actually described what that's like to change my mind as I go along. There's a piece called Teacup Fishing where I describe that and I show different images, you know, of that process.
Yeah, that was most enlightening. I really enjoyed that because it really took us through how that piece developed and what was in your head in terms of the art and how you wanted to express it. That was very good, yes.
Oh, thank you, thank you. It happens to some degree with every piece, but it was dramatic in that piece in that I really changed the structure of it, the layout, if you will.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a particularly good one. Yeah, and that was the other thing. You know, Beth and I have talked about this many times. Is that calming influence that doing needlework has on us? And you know, Beth even talked about going to give blood, and her blood pressure is too low because she's been stitching, so they can't take her. But yeah. When you say you work seated because that's what calms you down, so that you sit down and you just enter your own little world with your needle and thread, huh?
Yes. Well, my world is a little bigger because I listen to audiobooks. But yes, I in New York I used to have wood floors, so it was comfortable to sit on the floor. You know, it's not icy. Actually, if you can picture, say, a piece like Teacup Fishing, where there's, you know, it's about 4 feet high, I should say, roughly. In order to accommodate and not have to carry that weight, it's best to be on the floor so that I don't have to raise my arms. I don't have to lift it while I'm stitching. So, I think some people would like to know what it's like to work on such a large piece.
Yeah, I'd very much like to know about that, yes. Yes.
Well, I generally start with the eyes, whether they're in the middle of the piece or wherever, because I consider the eyes to be on a plane behind, say, the eyelids. So they're inside the flesh of the face. So the face is something that I have to get correct. If I want to make any errors, if I want to rush through, I can't rush through the face.
Okay, I want to stop you right there, Ruth, because when I was being taught photography, I was told if you're photographing animals, humans included, that no matter what you do, you make sure those eyes are in focus because the image will never work if the eyes are out of focus. And then when we look at your art, those eyes are just so powerful. I mean, they just set the stage for everything. I assume that you work very hard to get the eyes just right.
Yes, and the piece, the whole piece can't go forward if the eyes aren't correct.
Yeah.
What would I say? Okay, aside from being behind the eyelids, and me wanting to have the stitches of the eyelids go over the stitches of the eyeball, I have to get the proportions right so that the left eye is the proper distance from the right eye.
Oh.
Now, every face is not facing forward, so you can't use some sort of theoretical framework for what a face looks like. If the face is turned in any way, that's going to affect, you know, not only the distance between the eyes, but the size of the eye.
Right.
The eyes that are farther away from the plane are going to be smaller. The eye, it's going to be smaller than the eye that's closer to the front plane, to the viewer. Okay, so the eyes are not going to be, people's eyes are not the same size right to left anyway.
Yeah.
But, certainly you have to get it so that there's some sense that this is a solid three-dimensional object and not a two-dimensional, say, photograph, okay, or yeah. even painting. But in fact, while I do use photographs to draw from, I try my best so that the finished piece does not look like it's been drawn from a photograph. Mm-hmm. I want the realism of the photograph, but without the differences in contrast, say. You know, when you have a photograph, it's very high contrast. It'll be maybe almost all black or white, say, and yeah. very little shading in between. Okay, all photographs have some little bit of distortion in the contrast. So I try my best to remove that so that it looks as if I'm looking at the object directly and not at the photograph directly.
Oh, okay.
So you'll uh-huh. see a lot of people work from photographs because it's just too unwieldy to have someone sit for you for, 3 months.
Right.
So we use photographs, but I don't want to make an art piece of a photograph. And I always encourage my students to go beyond what is right in front of them. You'll see a lot of work that's not needlework, that's made from photographs, and it looks like a photograph. If do you agree? I don't know.
Yeah.
I see that all the time.
I see it in art quilts.
No matter how fancy it is otherwise. Yes. You see it where?
In art quilts.
Where did you say you see it, Beth?
In art quilts.
Yeah. Well, but you'll also see it in paintings. If you look at photographs of paintings, you can see, that was made with a photograph.
Hmm.
So you're looking at the photograph of a painting of a photograph. And that little bit of that psychological distance, that visual distance comes through. So I'm working against that. I want to be painterly. That's why I have, often used colors that are not in the photograph, that are imaginative. But still, even when I'm going way out there, I don't want it to look like a photograph of some imaginative object.
Every time we talk to one of these artists, I got to go look at other stuff to see, just to see what they're talking about. Okay. All right. Now I got to go study some more stuff.
Well, anything that I tell you, please, stop me if it's not clear. I'll look for some other words.
Okay.
That's one of the things that I aim for, even in, with the combination of narrative and drawing and color and everything. My objective is to communicate. I don't want to mystify anybody. Life is already mystifying. I should say.
Yeah.
And whenever I propose a story or a narrative, it's so that it can be of help to whoever is viewing it.
Mm-hmm.
Help to understand me, to understand themselves or life or whatever it is, but help in some way. So if I blow smoke on you, I'm getting in the way of that.
Yeah. Yeah, every one of your pieces seems to have some kind of a story behind it. Does that evolve as you're working on it? Because it takes you a year plus to do these life-size things. So that's a lot of thinking time. Does that evolve over time, or do you start in your mind many times with a story?
Yes, sometimes I start with a story. I prefer to start with a story. For one group of pieces that I did, I had my story in mind. And then when the model came, the whole story, two models, in fact, the stories went out the window, and I found that I was not a good enough photographer to capture the story with the models. That's another thing. It helps if you're going to look for a model. If your objective is to tell stories, it's helpful to find a model who's an actor. Mm. You know, they don't have to be a professional actor, but they have to know how to be the story instead of just holding a pose. Because when the model is posing, if they're thinking of something else, their body is following their mind. So you'd be surprised. Mm. I found that it really helps, you know, to have someone who is even an actor by nature. Now, say I got there and wow, these photographs are terrible. What am I going to do now? I always shoot while the model is there. So sometimes I come up with something lucky. They're doing something natural already. And now, if I sit and look and look and look and look at the shot itself, sometimes a story suggests itself. You know, what would I be thinking if I were doing such and such a thing? You know, that type of thing. And so a narrative can develop that way. But also, you know, say in the case of teacup fishing, I knew what the overall narrative was, but I just changed the details. You know, I looked for what would make the narrative more explicit. But I didn't change the narrative itself, which was to you know, not narrow oneself in the search for whatever you can get out of life. You know, that's the main theme of teacup fishing. So all the changes you see did not change that narrative,
okay,
that underlying narrative.
Yeah. One of the things I love to...
You know.
Go ahead. One of the things I loved about so
no,
much...
No, I'm through.
Okay. One of the things I loved about so much of your work is we have a main character, but then you have so many other things in the overall piece of art that enhance the meaning of that art or carry a message. And particularly, because what is it you have? Ones that are fully covered, where you cover the entire ground cloth. What do we call those? And then the
tapestries.
Tapestries. And then you have ones where you have open space, and you use that space and carry little messages. The trade-off standoff was one that really, really hit me. Where you deliver so much more than just the main character.
Oh, well, thank you. I like that piece as well. Now, that was one of the instances where the models just happened to be standing. So I said, oh, let me capture that. You know, they were a couple. So they happened to be standing together at the time. So I said, well, let me do the feet. And but if you can imagine the photograph before that piece, so it's just someone standing on the wood floor, two people standing facing each other on the wooden floor. But then, you know, my mind says, well, what does it mean to face another person? Especially as part of a couple. What's it like to be part of a couple? It's not always good. Sometimes it's almost never good. But usually there's a, you know, there's a combination of good and bad things, or expected and unexpected things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I got to think about that. And luckily that didn't take me a year. But even in that little bit of time, I found a way to elaborate on that message.
Yeah.
You know, of what is it to be part of a couple?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's striking. There's no question about it. Tell me about when I look at, like, when you say teacup fishing is a 4-foot piece, there's no way you sit and face that thing proper side up and stitch that whole thing. That just to develop the skill to turn that and stitch from all four sides must have taken an awful lot of work, and you must, your mind constantly adjusting as you stitch. That it's got to be an incredible challenge.
Yes, it was, and it is. Anytime I have a very large piece, if you can imagine me, say, sitting on the floor with maybe a chair on my right and on my left to balance the work, so that way I can, okay, what's it? I see you looking, Beth. Let me.
I know what you're saying. It's sitting on the floor that gets me. It's sitting on the floor that's getting me.
Okay, maybe I have a cushion, but
oh, okay, that's better.
Okay, so I'm on my cushion, and you know the work is balanced on something on the right and something on the left. But that allows me to see the top and feel the bottom without having to hold up the frame at the same time. Okay, so that's one aspect of it. Now, I try after the first piece, you know, which was incredibly difficult. That was flower. That's a self-portrait. That was bigger than teacup fishing. That's like 5x3. After doing that one, I made sure that the eyes were not in the very center of the piece because that's where the most struggle is going to be. Okay, so once, say I get the eyes and the face done. Okay, but so the less difficult places are on the edges of the canvas, number one. But I have to figure out I don't have 5-foot arms.
Right.
So,
right.
So I have to reach always from at least a foot and a half away. Oh, at least, I don't know, 2/3 of my arm length to get to the center of that piece. So from the top and the bottom, it's even further. So I have to shift, but I try to make the major decisions facing it head on. Uh-huh. But the other thing to take into consideration is that everybody is going to first see each piece from a distance. So I'm working at it close up. So I've got to put the stuff down and go across the room and look at it and see, is it working? Do the colors that look good close up, are they having the right effect at a distance, at 5 feet or 10 or 20 feet away, if I can manage it? If I'm in a big, I happen to have a large studio, so I can get maybe 15, maybe even 20 feet away. But, you know, that's a consideration in itself. Because even the idea of wearing glasses, I wear reading glasses now to stitch with. So, you know, everything is crystal clear when I'm looking at it, but maybe the values are off at a distance. Maybe it doesn't look so clear, you know, because I don't like to overdo it. So what can look clear from a distance is overdone when you close up.
Yeah.
So I have to really sort of make that negotiation with myself. You know, and try to figure out how I see things and how others will see them.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about, because for Beth and me, if something is more than 20 inches on the long side, that's huge for us. But you're
Right.
talking about feet, and you talk about that stitching under a magnifier, and then sooner or later you really need to step back to a reasonable distance to view it, because under a magnifier it's just you see all the flaws. And for you, it's got to be across the room so you can get a proper perspective on it. That's a whole different world. Yep.
Yes. And that's one of the reasons that it takes so long, because you have to count the time that it takes to get up and walk away. And then when you walk away, you have to stand there and think about it.
Right.
You know, what's working, what
Right.
isn't working.
Right.
Right.
And you have to remember when you get back.
Well, that'd be a problem for me already. I can forget quickly. Now the other part, and now I'm really blown away by this, but you talked about stitching 5 to 6 hours a day, 5 days a week is optimal. And now that I know that you're not sitting in a chair, you're sitting on the floor on a cushion. What about the ergonomics of that? Or have you just adapted to the point where you're just quite comfortable on a cushion on the floor, stitching all day long?
Well, actually, I was comfortable. I if I had really had my druthers, I would have been a dancer. So, because we had dancing lessons from age 6. So I took dance classes up until maybe age 50. So I was come I'm somewhat flexible. So, you know, when I worked at the post office, I had no energy for dancing. But aside from that, those 5 years, I was somewhat athletic. So I was, you know, being on the floor is not difficult in itself. And it's, you know, maybe even helpful.
Oh
But,
yeah, no doubt it's helpful. I tell you, I wish I had that flexibility. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And
But you were asking something. You
well,
were asking something else.
I was just curious about the ergonomics, and it sounds like if you have that kind of flexibility, then you're able to sit and stitch for long lengths of time, and I'm sure you're up and down, but for most of us to sit on the floor first would be a huge feat, and then to stitch on a four on a 4 foot piece would be even that much more. But so you have that flexibility working for you. Okay, I get it.
Well, let me put it this way. If I were to work from a chair, I would then have to find something higher than that to prop the work up on.
Yeah.
So, it's easier to get the body in shape to sit on the floor than it is to try to figure out which, you know, you can't move the dresser. You know, the dresser maybe accommodates one size. You know, so that's a consideration, because I don't really, unless I'm really caught up in something, I don't turn the work over to the reverse side. Now, every now and then I'll make tangles on the back, so then I have to turn it over. But I found a way to work so that I don't, for the most part, tangle up the yarn on the reverse side. Otherwise, that would be an issue.
Right.
Oh, funny thing. Funny thing. I went to get a flower, that first piece that I did. Flower was the first piece I made as a professional, when I said, okay, I'm a professional now. But so that was my first piece, and I used myself as a model, because not only do I come cheap, but I wouldn't have to explain it to anybody. So, okay, I finished the piece, and then I was bringing it to the framer, and she picked it up out of the wrapping, backside up, and she's like, "Oh, this is fabulous." You know, but she's looking at all the knots in the She hadn't seen the actual piece. She's just looking at the back. So I got a chuckle out of that too.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much, but please look at the proper side. Yes. Oh man. Yeah. Now, I'm curious, people who exhibit their work, that in itself is a huge undertaking to do an exhibit. But I'm always curious, what do you learn from doing an exhibit? I assume you're there for at least a couple of sessions where you talk to people who come in and look at your artwork. Do you learn things from that? Do you just talking with people?
Yes, I learn how to talk to people. When I was a teenager, I felt that my skill level was pretty much like it is now. It wasn't, but I thought it was. But certainly I thought it was good enough to make art that was sellable. Mm-hmm. So the unfortunate thing was that I was very shy and I didn't know how to approach a gallery owner, let alone a museum or any of these. How do you look for a collector? I had no idea. I didn't know how I would even, you know, what to wear, what to say, all this stuff. You know, if you're an artist, you have to figure that out. Mm-hmm. But I was lucky enough to, you know, early on in my career, I had gone to a frame store and the clerk asked me whether I intended to sell this type of work. And when I said yes, he said, well, you should try to postpone selling, you know, put aside the idea of selling and try to get it exhibited at places where you don't have to sell it so that you can make a name for yourself. And then because the prices you get are to a large degree based on the name that you have and the fame. That's why we see all kinds of art and we say, well, I could do that, you know, but you know, they have a name. Well, how did they get a name? Very often it's notoriety, but every now and then it's just based on the skill that they have. But there are so many artists who are really good and no one knows about them. So yeah. It's not based on talent. But anyway, what can one learn from an exhibition? Primarily what I learned was how to talk to people. So I had to approach people the way I'm approaching you. You are strangers to me now. So I find out what your interests are. You know, why have you come to see the work? Are you an artist? Are you not an artist? My first and solo show, the solo show that I had, I was allowed to actually design the entire show myself. And so that type of thing was built into the show so that people could see the things that I'm describing to you today as to how I actually work, what changes I make, you know, how an artist thinks, you know, what kind of judgments are made as in all types of things, and not just the look, but the narrative, and all other things that I can't think of right this minute, but all kinds of judgments get made. So I wanted people to understand those things because when they go to see an exhibition, you usually see a finished piece and you either like it or you don't. But it is so much more valuable to me to have people understand, well, what is it to be an artist? I want people to be artistic in the way they live. My art was made as as a way to assist myself into living better. I wanted to be a better person. I wanted to have a better character. I wanted to be a stronger person. So all these challenges that the business side of art brings forth, the exhibitions and all that, that was there to develop, you know, my social skills. As a shy person, I avoided social situations. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that right there, it, you know, if you want to go sell your art now, are you used to speaking to people? Can you actually right. describe in words why you did this and what it was it that you actually did, aside from how it looks? You yeah. know, I very seldom get back any feedback as to, you know, that will help me say, well, okay, I'll make a different kind of piece next time. Oh, that's okay. not what I have gotten from exhibitions, for instance. I used to sell crafts. So when I sold crafts, that would help me there. But mm-hmm. for artwork, it doesn't help me because it's so subjective. Art is so subjective that, you know, other people, they might say, well, you know, I would like you to make a piece of my Uncle Harry. I really loved him. You know, but that doesn't help me as an artist in deciding what to do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and in fact, I have really been loath to accept commissions. You know, I really like to chart my own path forward and decide, you know, what I'm going to work on.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Yeah, I wondered about commissions because yes. they dictate what you must do, which always seems contrary to what an artist wants. Yeah.
Yes, and you have to find something valuable in the person you're given to work with. So you, in my case, I would have to find a narrative, and they would have to give me a photograph that isn't posed with a smiley face, you know, or whatever, you know, Uncle Harry thought he should look like at the moment. You know, very few people are going to give you a photograph that you can work with,
yeah.
you know. And my art pieces are not all that dramatic, but I try to allow for the slightest bit of drama.
Yeah.
And, you know, and not being a good photographer, I can't even offer my own services to shoot the person, you know, if they're still living.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's key right there. Yeah. They're still living. Right. Yep. Well, Ruth, sure have enjoyed it. Thanks so much for making the time to do this. This has been a real, real terrific experience. Thank you.
Yeah.
You're welcome. You're welcome. May I add one more thing? Well,
oh, sure.
A couple of things. Your folks might want to know where to buy the yarn. Now, yes. there's a place. The place I used to go to is now closed, but I see that there's something called florilegium.com. That's florilegium, as in mother, .com. And they sell pattern iron yarns. Mm-hmm. And we didn't discuss fabric. I prefer, if I can, to get a coarse linen. And the reason for that is that linen does not stretch. Cotton stretches. It even when you pull it tightly, you know, once you start stitching, the yarn will distort the fabric. So linen has almost no stretch. It's like yarn made out of little twigs, as opposed to a spun type of fiber
yeah.
that cotton would be. So I prefer a coarse linen, and they can go to Dharma Trading, DharmaTrading.com. Because they have all types of fabrics. of different weights made yeah. for the crafter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you say coarse linen, what thread count are you talking? Thread per inch? You never look. Okay.
no, but let me imagine 20.
Oh, I was going to guess 20. Okay. All right.
Okay, yes. It's much coarser than sewing machine thread or even the thread that you use to sew the buttons on. It's maybe more like that. But I also wanted to say to your listeners who are interested in doing realistic work, to really put the time in when you're observing. The reason I do realistic work is because I'm always after truth. Truth and beauty, mm-hmm. both. I like to combine the two because they tell you where to go in life. You know, if you don't know where you are, if you don't know the truth of your current situation, how do you know where to step forward to? You know, everything is accidental at that point. So I always aim for truth. And I want them in their art and in their lives to aim for truth first. And beauty and its effect on us is calming and uplifting at the same time. So I say aim for beauty as well, but certainly truth. And take the time, whatever time it takes is worthwhile.
Yeah.
Until you find it.
All right, Ruth, thanks a lot. Really enjoyed it. Thanks to everybody for listening.